Advocates saved the WPA administration building at the state fairgrounds last summer. And now they're looking at ways to rehab it.
Instead of exterior exhibit space or more for selling corn dogs or whatever, use this as interior exhibit space.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, visitors to the Grand Canyon could get some retail with their views or in their view.
Why some congressional candidates in Arizona are waiting for the swift hand of justice before throwing their hats in the ring.
And new ways for patients to check their sugar.
One of the things that we've been trying to focus on is patient compliancy, patient acceptance, which typically would mean non-invasive and pain-free.
Plus, dwindling water in Wilcox and plastic v. plywood in Phoenix.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Nothing to tell you about in traffic. That seems incredible for a valley afternoon, but let's move on to weather then. Sunny skies continuing through the rest of the day. We're going to get ever so close to 100 degrees. The forecast high is 99. We're expecting clear skies tonight with overnight lows around 73. And then the forecast for tomorrow does call for a high of 101. Currently, relative humidity is at 7%, and it's 95 degrees.
With those 100-degree forecasts popping up in Valley Weather Reports this week, KJZZ's Kerry Young reports environmental managers are warning those hot temperatures also mean worsening air quality.
In the Valley, air quality becomes an acute issue in the summer. A recent report from the American Lung Association ranked Phoenix as one of the 10 worst cities in the country for ozone pollution, or what's known as PM2.5. Bob Hun with the Maricopa County Air Quality Department says Valley air pollution isn't quite as bad as the report makes it out to be this year. He explains that study only looked at records from 2011 through 2013.
2014 was a very good year for us. PM2.5, for example, for the first time in more than 10 years, we didn't have any exceedances on the holidays. And that shows you that the trends in the air is improving.
Hun says the air in Phoenix does meet federal standards. According to the Air Quality Department, the number of days that exceeded EPA guidelines has decreased more than 60% since 2012. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Officials expect this year's weather conditions to produce a rough wildfire season. So far, there have been about 300 fires this year, burning nearly 1,000 acres around the state. Governor Doug Ducey asks Arizonans not to throw fuel on the fire.
The vast majority of fires aren't caused by lightning strikes. They're caused by people. And with the wildfire season coming again into full swing, we must be vigilant about preventing fires and being ready to combat them when they happen.
The State Forestry Division is preparing for blazes similar to the Cave Creek Complex fire of 2005 and Rio fire of 1995.
This week, the U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee approved a bill aimed to stop construction of the Tohono O'odham Casino in the West Valley. This follows a series of legal decisions that have generally favored the tribe in this dispute. To try and sort out what's going on and what may happen down the road, we turn to Robert Clinton, Foundation Professor of Law in the Indian Legal Program at ASU's O'Connor College of Law.
It seems to me there's multiple possible outcomes, some favorable to the tribe and some not. As you know, there's a pending appeal in the latest litigation before the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Were it the case that the tribe loses that case, there's the possibility they may have invested a lot of money in starting construction and not be able to game at the facility. So that's one possibility. If they win that litigation, then in general, they're probably going to be relatively safe opening, but something's pretty odd about the litigation, which is that the agency which governs Indian gaming, which is the Indian Gaming Regulatory Commission, or the Indian Gaming Commission in D.C., has never had a chance to rule on the legality of gaming at this facility. And so there's the possibility that they could rule in the other direction, and that would put the tribe in the same position as if it had lost the litigation. And then finally, there's the possibility that any of the pending pieces of legislation might pass. And were that to happen, the tribe has invested a decent amount of money and would not be able to game at the facility.
Is there any kind of precedent for this? I mean, has this happened with other tribes in other states in the past?
Well, you've got precedents in multiple different ways. The basic problem of this casino is it's located on land acquired after the enactment of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act in October of 1988. And there's a prohibition in the Act on gaming on lands acquired after the date of the Act that contains a number of exceptions. The single exception that's relevant or potentially relevant to this particular situation is the settlement of a land claim exception. If they fall under that, the gaming would be lawful. If they don't fall under it, it would not be lawful. There's only one casino I know of that, in fact, has, through decisions and litigation, surmounted the settlement of a land claim effort, and that's the Seneca Casino in, I believe it's in Buffalo.
Do you expect a final resolution on this issue anytime soon?
Not real quickly. It's been going on for years. My guess is that if, in fact, the construction gets to the point where they're ready to open, and we actually haven't had a final resolution from the courts, there may be an interesting problem.
Legally speaking, other than the scenario that you just mentioned, legally speaking, does the fact that the tribe has started building the casino matter at all?
No, legally it doesn't. Though I think courts are somewhat reluctant to, in fact, unsettle expectations of parties that have already been backed by investment. And so, from the standpoint of legal theory and the law, it makes absolutely no difference. From the standpoint of the way the judges approach the case, it might weigh slightly in favor of the tribe.
Robert Clinton is Foundation Professor of Law at the Indian Legal Program at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The Grand Canyon is once again the focus of attention for a project with pretty clear dividing lines of conflict. Forest officials are hearing from the public on requests for easements that, if approved, could lead to a major development in the tiny town of Tucson, just outside of the Grand Canyon. There would be 3 million square feet of retail space put together by Stilo Development. Kevin Dahl of the National Parks Conservation Association says the project could put a major source of water at risk.
The water supplies are very limited. In fact, in the park, the water comes entirely from a spring on the north side of the park through a pipeline that goes all the way down to the Colorado River and back up to the top on the south rim. We're concerned that the development that's being proposed, if they use underground water, could severely impact all the springs and the little creeks on the south side of the Grand Canyon, including Havasu Creek, which is the major and only source of water for the Havasupai tribe. In addition to the water, it's a huge development compared to the little town now. There's less than 500 people there. It's maybe four or five blocks. And, it's a tourist industry town. They're talking about, expanding it to thousands of residential homes and a whole lot of commercial development, the equivalent of 10 big box stores, which is, it's just out of scale for that part of the world. People are going to the Grand Canyon for a transcendent experience, to see this iconic, spectacular place. They're not looking to do a lot of shopping.
What does it tell you about the whole thought process from folks who want to do that to Tucson?
You know, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think the developer is going to quickly build out this entire project as it's zoned. But as this is the only federal decision point on it, we really want the Forest Service to say, no, we can't allow this to happen when we don't know where the water is coming from and where the when the park and so many people have concerns about the scale of the proposed development.
How on guard do folks who want to defend that aspect of the canyon, how dedicated do they have to be considering this is one of those things that I think, obviously, clearly based on the developer's ideas, a lot of people think could make a lot of people a lot of money?
Well, ironically, that's been the history of the Grand Canyon. From the very beginning, there's been development schemes from a railroad down the length of it to people charging money to hike on the trails to proposed dams in the middle of the Grand Canyon to produce electricity. And there's continuing to be other proposed development schemes.
So, Kevin, at this point, what's being done from a legal standpoint and even a grassroots standpoint to block this from occurring?
Well, it's all focused on the Forest Service process now. They're scoping which is part of the environmental assessment process, where they're looking for all the factors that they want to include in their environmental studies. We've encouraged them to use their power of decision-making and just stop and deny them the permit right now. Go back to the drawing board, wait till the water has been figured out and the size of the development scaled down.
Kevin Dahl of the National Parks Conservation Association. Andy Jacobs of the Valley-based Policy Development Group is representing Stilo, the business putting together the retail, hotel, and housing plan in Tucson. Jacobs says Stilo has owned land there for a couple of decades and is aware of the water concerns.
This is Stilo's second attempt to do development near the Grand Canyon, and the first time around, they were involved in a project called Canyon Forest Village. And in the Canyon Forest Village plan, which was supported by the Grand Canyon National Park and other groups and stakeholders in the area, Stilo funded a water study done by Montgomery and Associates. And the water study did show, you know, there would be an impact on groundwater used. So Stilo actually put together a plan back in the Canyon Forest Village days to bring water by train, which sounds kind of funny, but it is a innovative way to not use groundwater, and it was deemed appropriate by all the entities that looked at it, including the County Board of Supervisors, the National Park itself, and the Forest Service, which was conducting the EIS. So this time around, we're looking at alternatives to groundwater. Right now, the town of Tucson uses groundwater. A town just a little south of there called Valley uses groundwater. So water is something that is very precious in the area. And so Stilo would like to lead an effort to be innovative in using alternative methods to bring water to the properties.
What are some of those options that you're referring to?
Some people do truck water into Tucson currently. That could be an option. But we see those more as Band-Aids at this point. We would like to take a harder look at alternatives like the Black Mesa pipeline, which is a old coal slurry line that is already underground, goes all the way to the Colorado River, to potentially get not only Stilo to use water that's not area groundwater, but other stakeholders in the area that may be the potential water users, including the town of Tucson and others that we've spoken to. So we're looking hard at a regional solution that could be a longer-term solution that could solve a lot of water issues in the area, not just ours.
What sort of response have you gotten to that from folks who are not excited about the project?
We've had some pretty low-level discussions with some non-governmental agencies that have said they're intrigued by it, including the Havasupai tribe, which, as you may know, the Havasupais rely on water for a major part of their economic development on their lands.
Why is Stilo pushed forward with this, considering the criticism from some that this is just a money grab?
There's just a different mindset from a European company than an American company. I think a lot of American developers would have said 20 years ago, holy cow, this is more trouble than it's worth. It's not worth the investment, and moved on to, you know, do another strip mall in Phoenix or something. But you're looking at a group of people, a group of individuals who saw an opportunity quite a while ago, and their love of the Grand Canyon, because the European culture has a very, very high respect for the Grand Canyon. We get a lot of European visitors to the Grand Canyon. And so I think they see it from a perspective of a worldwide phenomenon that they believe deserves more of a visitor experience, and think that they can bring that to the table. And so that's why they said, look, if the support isn't there, we're going to keep our property. It's not going anywhere. And then if there's support at another time, we'll make another run at it.
Andy Jacobs of Policy Development Group, which is representing Stilo. Public meetings are scheduled next month in Williams, Tucson, and Flagstaff on the proposed roadway and utility easements.
One of the surest signs of an abandoned house is boarded up windows. But Phoenix has started taking a different approach. The city is ditching plywood for something more transparent. To get a look, I met Phoenix's code compliance manager, Patrick Ravenstein, at one of the houses.
This is one of our abatement cases. The property was open and vacant, giving access to vandals that can break into the house and do damage or possibly bring in a small child. So our abatement team has abated the property, which means that they've contractually hired a contractor to come and put polycarbonate on the windows and secure the property so that it prevents access.
When you talk about polycarbonate, it looks like just plastic on the windows. Is that basically what it is?
Right. It's the idea is that it appears to be a normal window. In the past, we've boarded properties by putting plywood on the windows, which that attracts more vandals, that shows that nobody lives at the property. So this polycarbonate material actually looks like an actual window, and it's virtually unbreakable.
So is the hope then that people drive by and see what looks like a window there and think somebody lives there and maybe don't try to smash through the window or vandalize the house in some other way?
Correct. That's the idea. So as you drive by, you think it's just a normal occupied house. Like I said, the wood actually attracts more vandals and graffiti and things like that. So that's the concept.
If somebody decides, I'll take my chances anyway, how tough is that polycarbonate?
Well, we've had a couple council members and a very large police officer that have taken bricks and hammers and tried to smash through it and have not been successful. So I think it's pretty tough stuff.
So there's also a fence that goes basically along the entire property. If you wanted to get in, you'd have to hop the fence somehow. Is that part of the program also?
It's not. The fence that's here is part of the property. The owners have put it in. However, if there was a pool in the rear yard or there's some other hazard on the property, then we would hire a contractor to secure that, but putting a fence around it.
How much does this operation cost as opposed to using the plywood that you had done in the past?
Well, each one of these sheets are about $120 more per sheet than using plywood. But if you take in the cost of us having to come back over and over because more vandals have broken into the home, in the long run, it's much more cost effective. In addition, for the neighborhood, the appearance of the house, not being a blighted influence, not looking like it's vacant, also that's an added benefit as well.
When you talk about this in the long run being cheaper, I mean, how much would it cost if a house has plywood on it or maybe doesn't have plywood on it and it gets vandalized and someone from the city has to come and deal with that? How much does that run?
A normal board up, if we were originally to do it with wood, would cost about $1,500. That doesn't count into the staff time of sending out notices and researching who's the ownership and things like that. So if we don't have to come back and reboard and rehire another contractor to do it a second and third time, it definitely pays for itself.
How do you determine whether or not this is working and whether this is successful?
Well, certainly feedback from the neighborhoods. It's the most important aspect is that it doesn't look like an abandoned home. So when the neighbors are happy with it and it doesn't attract additional crime, then that's certainly one way. And then in the long run, as we look back, we'll see how many cases were where we didn't have to come back and re-secure property.
So at least at this point, is the plan to continue doing this into the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. Yeah, so far, we've had some really very positive feedback about it. So hopefully we can continue with this program and then make some improvements as we go along.
Patrick Ravenstein is Phoenix's code compliance manager. We'll post a photo of the new windows at theshow.kjzz.org.
Coming up, Medicare is looking into possible changes as more people choose hospice for end-of-life care.
If you're talking about, you know, how to rationalize treatment, well, you know, you don't want to necessarily be giving hip replacements to people in their 80s when you could, you know, if they're not going to live that much longer.
That's later on the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, an accident, I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue has the HOV lane blocked. Also an accident, 101 eastbound on the Scottsdale Road exit ramp. Sunny skies should continue for the rest of the afternoon. We are looking for a high of 99 degrees today. 90 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 70s. Sunny skies tomorrow right through the weekend with highs of 101 tomorrow, 98 Saturday, and 94 on Sunday. Right now it's 95 degrees at KJZZ at 223.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's Digital Culture Summer Institute, a faculty-led camp for high school students where computers and creativity collide. June 8th through 26th at the Tempe campus. summer.digitalculture.asu.edu.
Water is Arizona's most precious resource. While cities like Phoenix have stocked away enough to survive years of drought, that's not the case everywhere in the state. KJZZ's Will Stone takes us to one such place where dwindling water supplies are putting a strain on homeowners and businesses.
This is my well.
It was August last year when Mariah Miller ran out of water.
Isn't that crazy? I thought maybe if I put a big funnel, the rainwater could, you know.
She stoops over a dry pipe stuffed with rags that's sunken into the floor. Miller moved to Cochise County, a rural southeastern corner of the state, about 6 years ago. From her home, she runs a dog grooming business.
At first, you don't think that it's, like, really you're out of water. But, like, every time you go to the faucet and try to, you know, wash your hands or flush the toilet or do anything, I mean, it's horrible.
For a while, Miller came up with workarounds, asking customers to bring water, even running a hose from her neighbor's well. But eventually, without a consistent supply, things got tough. A new, deeper well would have cost $17,000.
I'm losing my house now, too, so couldn't keep my business going with no water.
We have come to a bend in the road where we all realize that this situation is unsustainable.
That's Murray McClelland, president of the Pearson Sites Chamber of Commerce. Over the past year, more than a dozen domestic wells in the area have gone dry. Unlike Maricopa County, everyone in this basin relies on groundwater, the vast majority of which goes to agriculture.
We have to level the playing field so that everyone can take advantage of a limited resource here in the Wilcox Basin.
McClelland says he's not anti-agriculture, but the industry needs to cut back to preserve the water table here. He points to data showing the aquifer has been overdrafted for decades, meaning water has been pumped out faster than it can recharge.
Yes, sir. We do use the bulk of the water.
Alan Seitz used to farm and now works for an agriculture retail supplier.
At the same time, everybody at the table needs to realize if the ag community goes away, the northern half of Cochise County is bankrupt.
Seitz is part of a local group trying to come up with a solution for the water shortage. And it's not as simple as farmers versus homeowners, he says. But unfortunately, there's a reality to living in the desert.
Particularly the homeowners, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but when they move to an ag area to retire and they drilled a well down, whatever that number is, 200 or 250 feet, in some cases, some of those wells just need to be deeper.
Basically, water isn't just a couple hundred feet below the surface anymore. Large farm operations can generally afford to drill deeper, but homeowners, not so much. To understand how it's gone so bad here, you have to go back more than 30 years when the state was rewriting its groundwater laws. Kathleen Ferris, now with the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association, was part of that effort and toured the state gathering input from locals.
We were basically overwhelmingly told in the Wilcox area to go away. They did not want to have groundwater managed. That was true in many other rural areas of the state.
So they focused on regulating much of the populated areas instead. And those management schemes have saved Arizona from a California-like drought crisis. But the rest of the state was left with essentially no restrictions on how much you could pump.
I didn't think it was a good idea at the time, but it was what was needed politically.
Now, after years of drought, the impacts are becoming clear. In fact, the state recently put a temporary moratorium on irrigating new farmland east of here. That could happen around Wilcox, too, unless another solution is found soon. Will Stone, KJZZ News, reporting from Wilcox.
Tomorrow we'll hear how the water shortage is dividing the farming community in Wilcox and the impact that could have on Arizona's wine industry.
Over the past decade plus, Medicare spending on hospice has expanded to about $15 billion. And in 2013, nearly half of Medicare beneficiaries who passed away had received hospice care. So Medicare officials are starting to look more closely at whether the funds are being spent properly and are within the hospice-related requirements. Gautam Gaurishankaran is an economics professor at the University of Arizona.
If they elect to be in hospice care, then Medicare pays for a lot of home health care and other end-of-life palliative care, but in exchange they agree not to have anything other than palliative care done for them. Basically, it's a way for people to lower end-of-life care costs while also making the end-of-life a happier time for people. But what I understand the changes are is that there's been a lot of issues where they said, okay, you're in hospice care because you have cancer, and then you agreed not to take invasive therapies, only palliative therapies, and then suddenly you break your hip. So that's not what's covered by the hospice care. So should you get hip surgery on it? And that's where they want to modify these to allow fewer of these procedures to be done.
Do you expect that sort of trend to continue based on what we're seeing, that more people will use hospice? So there should be a work through on this at some point where Medicare is wise to be looking into this?
So I think that there's really two potential issues going on with this policy change. One of the issues is just literally about double billing. And if that's the case, then Medicare should definitely be should be looking to stop it, because double billing is illegal in general, right? But the other issue is more subtle, and it's about incentives. And it's saying, well, if you have hospice care, do you have an incentive then to push people in, to get people into hospice care, but then to claim that a lot of stuff that maybe is tangentially related to the reason they're in hospice care, to their terminal illness, really isn't part of it? And that's where it's not about whether something's illegal, but it's more a gray area. It's more about incentives. So in terms of whether, to get back to your question of whether Medicare should do this or not, well, definitely if they think that there's double billing going on, then they should do this, because they should be stopping Medicare fraud. And if they think that it's not a question of fraud or double billing, but it's more a question of incentives and aligning incentives, then I think that the fact that more people are going into hospice care suggests that this is going to be more important to make sure that the incentives are aligned for hospice care, so they don't sort of define it too narrowly.
As the average lifespan continues to extend, what are the other possible complications you're expecting to see?
There are statistics on how much we spend on end-of-life care, and I think, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's 25 or 30% of healthcare spending is on people in their last year of life. This is where the money is, right? It's in people who are not in good shape, who may not live that much longer. And we really, and it's a tough issue, because on one hand, we don't want to say, if my parents, were at a slip and fall, I don't want to say, oh, they're old, they don't deserve good care. On the other hand, if you're talking about, how to rationalize treatments, you don't want to necessarily be giving hip replacements to 80, people in their 80s, when you could, if they're not going to live that much longer. It's going to be a huge issue to figure out how we allocate care in a way that's equitable and fair, but also doesn't continue to escalate healthcare costs.
Gautam Gaurishankaran, economics professor at the University of Arizona.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
We have one more plate coming today.
My niece and I come down once a month and do various jobs here at St. Vincent. Today we're greeting guests.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good.
You're welcome. Enjoy dinner.
Yeah, ask them how their day was, maybe their name, if there's kids. Ask them questions that get them excited.
Are you hungry?
No.
No?
Thank you so much.
Have a turkey. Hi.
Everything here at St. Vincent is restaurant style. So we seat them, we take their orders, we bring their food out to them. We clear the tables, just like if you were in a restaurant.
Can I get 5 chicken strips with everything?
I recognize that I had more than most people and time to give, so to be able to give back to them and really serve the place that I've lived for 16 years is very fulfilling.
Dear Jonathan, happy birthday to you.
That was Yvonne Marchaud and her niece Alexis Arlac volunteering at St. Vincent de Paul during dinner time. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. And still to come, some potential congressional candidates in Arizona may be waiting on a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court before jumping in.
I think it's tough to convince someone to get into a race when you can't guarantee that the district they're running in is going to exist, or that race is going to exist when they finally get to Election Day.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show at 2:33 on KJZZ. No surprise, we'll stay mostly sunny and hot for the rest of the day. We're expected to reach a high of 99. And then we may hit our first 100-degree high tomorrow. The forecast high is 101, a nice way to kick off the month of May. And then look for clear skies coming up for the next couple of days as well, overnight, with lows in the lower to mid-70s. It's currently mostly sunny and 95 degrees. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, accidents I-10 westbound at 12th Street. That one's blocking the center lane. Also, I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue. HOV lane is blocked. And the 101 eastbound at Scottsdale Road, there's a collision on the off-ramp.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting box office blockbusters with music from the movies. The performance includes scores from Titanic, The Godfather, Star Wars, and more. Two shows May 2nd. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Baltimore police have turned over to Maryland prosecutors the results of their investigation into the death of Freddie Gray. The report is not being made public, but Deputy Police Commissioner Kevin Davis says the findings include the fact that the van that transported Gray to a police station made a previously undisclosed stop along the way.
This new stop was discovered from a privately owned camera.
The Maryland State's Attorney's Office is calling for the people of Baltimore to remain patient and peaceful while it completes its own probe of the case. A 15-year-old boy and a young woman have been rescued from the rubble of collapsed buildings in Nepal's capital 5 days after a powerful earthquake hit that country. The boy, wearing a New York T-shirt, his face covered with dust, was found not to have any serious injuries. He spoke to reporters and said he began crying out for help when he heard the sound of equipment digging nearby through the rubble. NPR's Kurt Sigler is in Kathmandu. He says there's a real sense of unease there.
People are still very wary here about going back to their homes. Some people's homes are still intact, others not, but we've just continued to have aftershocks.
NPR's Kurt Sigler in Kathmandu, where people are also facing shortages of food and clean water. Hillary Rodham Clinton has her first official competition in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. He is independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He says he'll make the economic disparity in the U.S. a major theme of his campaign.
We can't continue having a nation in which we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major nation on earth at the same time as we're seeing a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires.
Sanders describes himself as a democratic socialist. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 195 points at 17,840. The NASDAQ lost 82 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
A group of architects, structural engineers, and contractors, among other people, has finished a building assessment on the 1938 WPA Administration Building that's at the State Fairgrounds in Phoenix. It was the building at the center of a controversy last summer after the fair announced plans to tear it down. The assessment looks at both the interior and exterior and all aspects of possible repairs. For more on what the document means and what's next for the building, I met Jim McPherson, board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation, just across the street from it.
Since September of last year, a group of fairgrounds officials, nonprofit preservation advocates, building specialists, neighborhood groups, folks interested in the fair in general have gotten together on a monthly basis to look over alternatives to demolition. A formal building assessment has been written and has recently been published, and we're now reviewing that document with fairgrounds officials and everyone else to see what are the options available.
So do you have a sense yet of what it would take to get this building up to code and to a point where it could be used for something now?
There's another aspect of the report is giving cost options. So a low-cost option, medium option, high option, depending on the use. So for example, if you just went into the interior and used it as open exhibit space, that would be much less costly than, say, offices or classrooms. Definitely the roof is the major concern, but once that's repaired, the other work can then happen that opens the space up, beautifies the exterior, brings it back to its former glory, and hopefully a good use.
What are some of the uses that would both protect the building and preserve the building, but also generate some revenue for the state fair, which is one of the reasons that the fair was talking about getting rid of it in the first place?
Exactly. Totally understand the need for revenue in an era of the Great Recession and declining state revenues and all those other issues that all state agencies must deal with. We're saying instead of exterior exhibit space or more for selling corn dogs or whatever, use this as interior exhibit space. That's one use, and it's totally fair related.
So what's the next step now in terms of trying to get something else into that building?
So the formal report is a great tool to present to potential developers, to the fairgrounds officials themselves, to say, what would it take for you to take over this building as a project?
Do you have a sense that there are developers who would be interested in working on this?
I believe so. I've shopped it around already to a couple that I know of who have done historic rehabs here in Phoenix and even down in Nogales. These projects dot the state. We believe this could be one of those future projects.
Best case scenario, what do you think is a reasonable time frame for finding a use for the WPA administration building and starting work on it and having it ready to go as its new use?
You're asking me to use my crystal ball. It's getting down to crunch time from the standpoint of making a decision, working with the fairgrounds officials on a decision to preserve or protect. And again, because of the materials, the information we have, and the efforts underway to find developers and funding to do, you know, a project, a rehabilitation project, I'm hopeful that within this year and a half, something will be underway.
In your mind, what does the state gain by having these buildings preserved and being in use now? And what would the state lose with these buildings going away?
Well, here we are at the Arizona State Fairgrounds. We're looking at it and we see several buildings, but on the other side of the building is like 80% asphalt. And by taking down any one more building adds to the asphalt. And we just don't see that as a wise stewardship of our history and making this an inviting place for future fairgoers.
Jim McPherson is board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. The WPA administration building is not the only historic building at the fairgrounds that needs some love. McPherson says there are five others. And next month, an Oregon-based company will be here to do some 3D surveying of one of them. Paul Tice is founder and CEO of Topa 3D.
It's an architectural survey project is what it really is. And what we're going to be doing is doing 3D laser scanning on these buildings and creating architectural drawings so that they can actually take that information to help rehab the buildings. And then those drawings are going to go into the Library of Congress. Really, the 3D laser scanning is a technology that is pretty extraordinary, very high tech, and it gives us the ability to sort of do a survey like you would see a surveyor on the street doing a roadway. You know, they shoot one laser at a time. We're shooting almost a million lasers per second with this technology in all directions.
How do you do that? I mean, does somebody have to be in the building physically to get the lasers into all the different corners of a structure?
So what we have is a technician that will be out in the field. I'll probably be out there in this particular project. And the scanner actually mounts on a tripod in this situation, and it fires lasers in all directions from a particular vantage point. And after that's complete, we move it to another location, maybe a few feet or a few meters away, and we scan again. And we go sort of leapfrogging all the way around the structure, interior and exterior. And then later in the post-processing phase, we take all of those scans and we stitch them together to make a full 3D model.
So do you ultimately end up with what amounts to like a 3D blueprint of a building?
That's exactly right. And those blueprints can get converted into architectural drawings or architectural 3D models. And what's really the best part of this is the 3D laser scanner is a measuring tool. That's really what it is. And so these 3D models and these 3D images are measurable within 2 millimeters. So everything is scaled appropriately.
When you get into the buildings and do all this, do you just get measurements out of it? Are the lasers or is there any other technology able to sort of tell you what about the building maybe needs repair or structurally if there are issues with it?
So the laser scan data in itself can produce several types of analytical tools. One of those tools includes geometric measurements, but also there's a part of this that you can extract from the laser scan data called intensity backscatter. Intensity backscatter is a sort of analytical tool that the lasers naturally produce that allows you to see different types of materials allows you to see water, allows you to see walls that are out of plane or bulges in the walls or in the rooftops based on some sort of damage. And so what we can do is produce sort of a technicolor analysis of all the building components, the facades, the roof, and that sort of thing with this tool. So not only can we get the geometry and all the measurements of the tool of the building structure, but we can also analyze what's happening with the structure itself. So if there's mineral leaching on some of the adobe walls or any of this kind of thing, we can actually see that. And it may not be perceptible to the human eye, but it's perceptible to the laser scan data when we look at it through analysis software.
Paul Theis is founder and CEO of Topa 3D. Paul, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
The monologue is a theatrical device that's been used since the plays of ancient Greece. The speaker addresses the audience and dramatizes their lines to draw out emotion.
A few years ago, one author created a series of monologues to be delivered in silence. That's because they're in American Sign Language, or ASL.
The Deafhood monologues will show in Phoenix this weekend. The show's Annika Klein has more about how this performance uses ASL to capture the experiences of the deaf community.
Think about the way a line changes when someone emphasizes the words differently.
Boy, these pretzels are making me thirsty.
These pretzels are making me thirsty.
Oh, these pretzels are making me thirsty.
An ASL speaker can add emphasis by exaggerating signs and facial expressions. The sign for big can just be made bigger. And that's what Jack Cook says is so great about sign language. Here she is, speaking through an interpreter.
How we sign it, it's almost like a portal into our world. It's 4D. Really, it's not 3D, but 4D. And people can just immerse themselves into our world and feel like they're right there.
Cook is the director for the Phoenix production of the Deafhood Monologues. She and other deaf women worked with author Ella Mae Lentz to gather real stories from the deaf community and adapt them for the stage. Here's Lentz through an interpreter.
These aren't just stories about how deaf people have broken ears. We are so much more than that.
The stories are about things like going to a ball game but not being able to see the person signing the national anthem, or about deaf teachers who sign especially beautifully. Lenz says these stories help hearing people better understand the deaf community. And for deaf audience members, she says the joy is seeing their own stories in the spotlight.
They look at the show and go, wow, the entire show is about our experiences, the whole thing, from the hard times when we've struggled to the funny things that make us laugh.
Lenz says this is one of the only shows out there that attempts to reframe the idea of deafness as a culture and identity. The proceeds from the performance will go to the Arizona Association for the Deaf and the Deafhood Foundation to continue that work offstage. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The Deafhood Monologues will be in Phoenix on Saturday at the Phoenix Day School for the Deaf. It'll also show in Tucson on Sunday, and all shows will have an English interpreter. To see part of the performance, visit kjzz.org, and a thank you to the Deaf and Hearing Network for their assistance with interpreting.
The National Football League kicks off its annual draft in just a few hours. It's become such a spectacle that the Pick'em has left its usual New York City home for Chicago. Thanks to an atypical playoff appearance last season, the Arizona Cardinals' initial selection won't be until the 24th pick. We caught up with Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, who's been covering the Cardinals for nearly two decades. Kent, after the draft, there are always opinions expressed and grades given as to how well a team did. How long do you wait to see whether the Cardinals or another team actually had a successful draft?
You know, it's fun to assign grades to it right away, and fans love to read that stuff. But to do it accurately, I think you've got to wait probably 2 to 3 years.
Ken, in the couple of years that the Steve Keim, Bruce Arians regime has been going, the team has had a couple back-to-back successful years, which hasn't happened too many times in the history of the organization. How important is it for an organization to be in sync when it comes to the draft and then coaching up the players, or however they like to phrase that kind of thing?
It's been difficult for the Cardinals in the past. There have been a lot of disconnects between the football management and the coaching part of it. You know, I go back to when Dave McGinnis was the coach in the early 2000s, and, you know, Terrell Suggs, who's now with Baltimore, was there with the 6th overall pick, and the coaches badly wanted them to take Terrell Suggs, and instead the Cardinals traded down and passed up the chance to, you know, take a guy who's one of the best pass rushers in the league. And over the years, the Cardinals have drafted people that the coaches really didn't want to coach. They were not high on them, but scouts were, or a general manager was, and it just didn't work out. And I think that has changed. Steve Keim was very involved in the process of hiring Bruce Arians. They hit it off immediately. They have a similar philosophy, and I think there's a great respect.
So somebody, let's say in the past 5 years where surprisingly the Cardinals really hit on this person that people weren't hyping, and then someone that they drafted pretty high first, second, third round that they really had high hopes for who just really flamed out very quickly?
The big one currently that needs to prove himself is their first pick in 2013, Jonathan Cooper, the guard from North Carolina, the 7th overall pick, Steve Keim's very first draft pick as general manager. And Cooper has been hurt in each of his first two seasons. There are, questions about his toughness, et cetera. They have hit on some players. They took a chance in 2013 on Tyrann Mathieu in the third round, and he had failed multiple drug tests at Louisiana State, been kicked off the team, and a lot of people, including myself, questioned at the time if it was a smart move taking him. And he's been a productive player and seems to have turned his life around.
Kent Summers covers the Arizona Cardinals for AZ Central Sports. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. Next week, we'll bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action, too. Just solve this puzzle. Find a number less than 100 that is increased by 1/5 of its value when its digits are reversed. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Good afternoon, this is KJZZ, and you're listening to The Show, an original production that mixes news and features from the Valley, the region, national, even international news to provide you a stream of engaging radio.
KJZZ is supported by the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, presenting SCNM Thrive, energy, health, and empowerment through community programming, now enrolling for yoga, healthy cooking classes, and more at scnm.edu.
We're still a ways away from being bombarded with ads and robocalls for congressional candidates, but it's not unusual to see them jumping into the race this far out from Election Day. This year, however, is a bit different in Arizona, and that's due in large part to a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Earlier this year, the justices heard arguments over whether the state's Independent Redistricting Commission is allowed to draw congressional districts, or if that job belongs to the legislature. A decision is expected in a couple of months. For more on the impact of that ruling and the waiting until we hear it is Nathan Gonzalez, editor of the D.C.-based Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report.
I think that the House races in Arizona are somewhat on pause as we wait for the Supreme Court's decision on redistricting. On one hand, I think that the redistricting decision is having an impact on candidates and their decisions whether to run. On the other hand, I think some of the candidates might just be using it as an excuse to wait. Most normal people don't want to spend 2 years of their life running for Congress. So any excuse to maybe delay that decision a little bit longer is probably okay with some of them.
For those candidates who legitimately would get into the race absent the uncertainty about the Supreme Court decision, what kind of impact is this delay or will this delay have once they decide to get into the race if they do?
Well, I think most candidates or most potential candidates like to take calculated risks. They like to know what they're getting into, and if you don't know the shape of the district, the geography of a district, it's tough to understand how difficult or how easy of a road you're going to have in the next election.
If the Supreme Court rules that the lines need to be redrawn, that obviously takes time for the legislature to redraw them, at what point does it become really late for a candidate to get into the race or decide to get into the race and start fundraising, campaigning, all that stuff?
Well, the short answer is it depends. It depends on where they're running. Where do they start from? Are they a local office holder who has a base of name identification to work from, or are they starting from zero name ID? And what does the rest of the field look like? Are they still going to have to face an incumbent? Is it an open seat? There are just a lot of factors that are unknown right now until there's certainty on the congressional lines.
Is this entire process, do you think, hurting efforts by the parties to recruit candidates, especially those to run against incumbents?
I think it's tough to convince someone to get into a race when you can't guarantee that the district they're running in is going to exist, or that race is going to exist when they finally get to election day. You know, because so many of these candidates, you can't run for office and have a full-time job, or at least I think it's extremely difficult, and to have a candidate make sacrifices, and then 6 months later it's all thrown out the door because the district doesn't exist, I think is, you know, it's tough to see party strategists able to pull a lot of people through that. One of the factors I think at play here is that these House districts and this decision could have an impact on the United States Senate race. I think there is a scenario where Republicans redraw the 9th district to be so Republican that Senate Democrats hope that Congresswoman Sinema decides that running against John McCain is actually a better opportunity for her than running for re-election because of the shape of a new district. And so it's not just the House races. I think this has the potential to impact the Senate race as well.
Nathan Gonzalez is editor of the Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report. Nathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Diabetic patients routinely have to check their blood sugar levels, and that means pricking their finger each time. But researchers at ASU are working on different approaches, specifically ones that do not include needles. Jeff LaBelle, a professor of biomedical engineering at ASU, has been looking at this since about 2007.
One of the things that we've been trying to focus on is patient compliancy, patient's acceptance, which typically would mean non-invasive and pain-free.
So are you looking at ways to try to make sure that people who need to check their sugars will do so, maybe, and increase that by not having them have to prick their finger so often?
Right. And it also, you know, if there's a way to reduce the amount of, you know, baggage you have to carry with you to do so, that would be awesome, too.
Where else can one check for sugars? Are there other, I assume there are other fluids that one can check with?
Yeah, historically it started actually in urine. So the diabetic used to be able to get their urine glucose test. And, you know, in ancient days it was actually a taste test. Luckily we've changed from that. Kind of the standard of care right now is the finger prick. But we've been investigating tear fluid very heavily in the past decade in my lab, and then and it's been heavily researched across the nation for a while, but we feel we're really onto, you know, something there, and that's now extended us to go back to the old question of, you know, could we do it also in saliva, both of which have severe challenges that have to be accomplished first.
What are the challenges?
Well, very synergistic to tear fluid. Tear fluid's been studied since 1930, and there's been a lot of research done in this area, and one of the things that's been compiled by other people, so I'm building upon others' knowledge, that sometimes you don't get it because you stimulate the eye, which causes a glucose spike, which is kind of like a stress response. You're damaging the eye, and so the body responds with a spike in glucose, and that's kind of artificial. It's not correlating to blood glucose normal levels. So one of our technologies has been to non-stimulating ways to get tear fluid from the eye. And our hypothesis basically is that the saliva is going to be partially part of the problem, will lie in that area too. In tear fluid, there are other challenges as well. Just like in saliva, there's other challenges.
With saliva, would you have to wait a certain amount of time after eating something? I can imagine somebody like eating a candy bar, for example, then checking their blood sugar, which maybe they shouldn't be doing anyway,
yeah.
And, you know, getting this reading that's just off the chart because there's still sugar from what they just ate in their saliva.
Right. You know, that's actually very, that's one of the other challenges, and that's very synergistic to a person having to wash their hands in order to finger prick.
Do you think that different methods, either tears or saliva, might be preferable or better for different types of patients?
Now, you kind of started to hit into a little bit of the business side of it, what's going to be marketed What's easier, acceptance, patient's acceptance. But then also, you know, someone that's much further along in their progression of disease may have more eyesight challenged, and it might be easier for someone to test saliva rather than the tear fluid. The tear fluid, you know, it may end up being something that an ophthalmologist or an optometrist would have to do, or, you know, a doctor. Hopefully with saliva, it'd be something that it can be easier self-tested.
So in your mind, what do you think is the soonest that a diabetic patient might be able to get away from pricking their fingers and maybe take a saliva test or a tear test?
Oh, boy. I wish I could say tomorrow, but there, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of research that still has to go into these areas and development. And, you know, basically, we ultimately have to show that they do work and then that they're safe, and then label them, say, you know, properly so safety is there, you know, they're actually being used properly. So, unfortunately, there, you know, there's still a lot of work.
We're looking at probably years.
Years.
Professor Jeff LaBelle with ASU School of Biological and Health Systems Engineering. Jeff, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's face it, we all have to deal with pesky intruders from time to time, right here in Phoenix or in the fictitious town of Pawnee, Indiana, on NBC's Parks and Recreation.
Fairway Frank is this awful possum who lives near the sixth hole of the public golf course, and he's actually number three on the Parks Department's most wanted pest list.
It turns out that Phoenix's Fairway Frank is not a possum, but a coyote that hangs out at Talking Stick Golf Club in Scottsdale. The coyote approached a group of women golfing, and when they tried to drive away in their golf cart, it ran after them. So what did they do? We asked golfer Amy Kirkus.
We were looking for what could deter him, and we had some sandwiches on our cart, so we took a quarter of a sandwich and threw it off, not in the bushes, but towards the bushes, hoping that he will focus on the sandwich and not us anymore.
And it worked. Kirkus guesses she wasn't the first to feed the crafty coyote. So if you've got a tea time coming up, don't forget the sandwiches, roast beef, hold the horseradish. And be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2. Among the stories we'll have for you, can Phoenix become a walkable city? And the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame actually gets a hall. Those stories and much more coming up on the show tomorrow afternoon at 2.
Today's show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shad, and Maria Springs are our digital team. The news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is the verdant one, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. We want to know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. The show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody for Steve Goldstein. Thanks so much for listening today. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.